Israeli planes bombed the building we lived in, killing 27 people. 16 of those martyrs were children.
Children had invented some games, keeping themselves amused. They played with cardboard and stones. I used to teach them the Quran. I used to gather them in a circle for almost an hour every day, and everyone would open their Qurans.
The war had just started. We could hear the sounds of air attacks and bombings. I'd go out and play football or other games right under this balcony. My sister would cry and complain about me playing outside, saying that I might get shot. She kept asking my mother not to let me go out.
Zaina was very dear to him, his teacher and his guide. Whenever I admonished Hassan, she would hug him and say, "Mom, don't hit him." It was as if she was his mother, not his sister. During the holidays, she would be his teacher, teaching him Arabic. She'd wipe the whiteboard clean and tell him, "Enough of Arabic. Now let's move on to English." And then she started talking in English.
Because this house was half finished, it did not have enough living facilities. Therefore, if anyone wanted water, they had to fetch it from the outside. And women took their children to their houses to change their clothes and do other things and then came back. Israeli planes would film all that from above. They knew that only children, women, and old men lived here. The Israelis were well aware of the fact.
The night when that massacre happened was very dark. It was about 1 a.m. Because Zainab's skin was sensitive to mosquito bites, I used to get up in the middle of the night and wave the mosquitoes away. So I was half awake when I noticed that half of my body and my feet were buried under the rubbles. I could hear men shouting, "God is great, God is great, we are under attack." Allahu Akbar, qasafuna, qasafuna. I removed the stones covering Hassan. Not many stones had fallen over him, but apparently something had hit him on the head and it was bleeding. Of course, at the time of the attack, all the neighbors came to my help. I asked them to take Hassan, telling them that I had talked to him and he seemed to be all right. They passed him over one by one until he reached safety. While Hassan was being carried by them, he'd pass out and regain consciousness, and they thought he was dead too.
They took away the wounded, and those killed had to wait till the next day when rescue forces arrived. The Red Cross and reporters came and covered the news.
I was looking for Zainab and calling out to her. I kept looking for her, calling out, "Zainab, this is your mother. Answer me." I found the hand of a girl near the place where Zainab had slept. I thought it was Zainab. I kissed her hand and talked to her, telling her, "Honey, I can't do anything for you."
At such moments, man turns completely towards God. No one can replace him for man. At such moments, man is only interested in God, going back to his nature from which God has created human beings. It comes to the surface at such moments.
When they were washing my daughter's body, I recited the surahs she used to recite at school. I told her, "Don't be afraid, my dear. You're going to see God. The Prophet and his dear household will be there. Lady Zainab will be there. And you're going to have the best mother in the world now." Zainab's absence affected me greatly after the war. Zainab had beautiful hair. She used to stand in front of the mirror and have me brush her hair. When I returned home, I went to a hair salon and had my hair cut short, very short. I didn't want to stand in front of the mirror and brush my hair because my Zainab's hair was buried deep in the ground. When the war was over, I told my husband, "Go to a doctor and get treatment. We might be able to have another baby for Hassan's sake." When he watched other women giving birth to babies and other children hugging their sisters or brothers, he would get really upset because he had no siblings. It was at the beginning of Ramadan, the fourth or fifth of the month. My husband and I were talking at night. He said, "Have you promised Hassan any siblings? We need to have at least $4,000 for artificial insemination. This is not a small amount. Don't even have a penny to our name." I said, "We had the same problem before Zainab was born, and I got a loan from the school. The doctor who had observed the test believed that it was impossible for us to have children without getting treated first. But I said I'd put my trust in God, and that was the only thing passed between us. We slept after that. I had a dream about a man who was wearing very old clothes. He was coming towards us. I was sitting beside my husband and he hadn't reached us yet because he was a long distance from us. He told me by his gestures that he was a relative of my husband. He finally reached us. He had a beautiful face. He pointed to my husband and said he would pay for the artificial insemination. And he put his hand on his chest like this. He said, 'If you accept my offer, I'd like to invite you to lunch.' And my husband said, 'As you please, I'm at your service.'" Just these two sentences, "as you please" and "I'm at your service." We went with that man. A woman wearing a scarf was with him. She wasn't wearing black. She was wearing clothes of different colors. Her clothes were old too. She was there to serve me, and the man was there to serve my husband. I'd never seen such dishes before. The table was very long, and I couldn't see the end of it. I started to eat like I was starving to death, as if I was trying to stuff myself with food. I picked the food from here and there. When I woke up, I woke my husband up and told him about my dream. He asked me, "You woke up to tell me about your dream?" I said, "It was beautiful." He said, "I hope it has a good interpretation." One of my colleagues who teaches the Quran at school is a devout believer. I told her, "Ma'am, I had a dream I found very interesting, and I'd like to tell you about it." She asked me about my dream, and I told her. She asked me if my husband and I intended to get treatment in order to have children. I said, "Yes, we've made an appointment for artificial insemination at American University Medical Center." She put her hand on my shoulder and said, "You should get pregnant without any treatment." As soon as she said that, I felt my whole body go cold and felt my skin crawl. I said I hope it would end well. Then I asked her who that man and woman in my dreams were. She said, "You were invited to Jesus Christ's banquet. Jesus Christ could bring the dead back to life and heal the sick. If you and your husband have any sickness that prevents impregnation, you've been cured with the help of God and Jesus Christ." 3 days before the end of Ramadan, I found myself with child, and Isa was born. Right, Hassan. We're going to recite Surah Al-Nasr in a beautiful voice. Are you ready?
إذا جاء نصر الله والفتح ورأيت الناس يدخلون في دين الله أفواجا فسبح بحمد ربك واستغفره إنه كان توابا.
A true believer never loses hope in God. Our future lies in the hands of God, and a future lying in the hands of God is a safe one.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Despite the hypocrisy and continuous lies of the American statesmen, the world public opinion is well aware of the black human rights record of this regime and will not be deceived by their rhetoric and political shows. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times noted, there were few things America's left and right will agree upon. One area of agreement is that America aspires to set the gold standard when it comes to human rights. And as we know, elected officials from across the political spectrum will be quick to criticize certain countries for their perceived human rights deficiencies. America's imperfect effort at being the leader in human rights has taken a beating this summer, and there is no reason to believe the situation will improve. Two items will be briefly addressed now, and then considerable time will be spent on a third. First, mass shootings continue on a daily basis, and there is no domestic political will to do what it will take to fix the problem. In the first 5 days of July alone, 24 people from all parts of the U.S. died from gun violence, an average of roughly 5 per day. Last year, more than 20,000 Americans died via homicides. There is no other way to put this. Too many Americans have come to accept that they must live with the fear of being close to or part of such an event. You cannot square America's commitment to human rights leadership with a population knowing at any moment that a mass shooting might happen in their community or to them personally. Second, a scathing report was recently released showing that maternal mortality rates are on a steep rise throughout the U.S. Quoting the report, in 2021, 1,205 women died of maternal causes in the United States, compared with 861 in 2020 and 754 in 2019. The maternal mortality rate for 2021 was 32.9 deaths per 100,000 live births, compared with a rate of 23.8 in 2020 and 20.1 in 2019. And yes, as you might guess, black women were especially at risk, with 70 deaths reported for every 100,000 live births. Here again, you cannot square America's commitment to human rights leadership when the country's most vulnerable women are at risk of dying from giving birth, and most of the country simply shrugs with indifference. Come to think of it, how can American conservatives, always quick to talk about their commitment to the right to life, not look at that information and demand that money and resources be used to address maternal death in the United States? Might the reason be that white women are less likely to die during childbirth? And there was this headline in July 7 edition of the Washington Post. More than 100 migrants died from heat near U.S.-Mexico border this year. Parts of the U.S. have dealt with intense heat this summer. The New York Times noted, as of July 8, about 49.5 million people, 15% of the population of the contiguous United States, live in the areas expected to have dangerous levels of heat. A quick glance of the map tells you that the southeast and the southwest, where the U.S. border with Mexico is located, are baking under a hot sun. Yes, people with air conditioners and other mechanisms to cool off will tolerate the heat, but America's poorest people often lack such luxuries. The migrants at the border who continue to seek entry into the United States so that they may have a better life definitely do. We will set aside the argument about refugee versus migrant and simply acknowledge that migrant makes a person seem less needy and less deserving of a human touch. The heat is dangerous, but the response to it from the United States Customs and Border Protection was heartless. Through a tweet, the agency stated, "Rising temperatures along the southwest border during the summer make the dangerous trek to cross into the U.S. unlawfully even more treacherous. Do not endanger your lives by embarking on the hazardous journey to the United States." Read those words carefully and then remember the words at the base of the Statue of Liberty, a symbolic beacon of America's commitment to human rights. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Let us ignore for a moment that the offensive tweet is not likely to reach the intended audience. That is a minor issue when compared to the fact that someone was callous. The author of that tweet wantonly threw into the garbage the country's belief in giving succor to people in distress. Dig deeper into the aforementioned Washington Post story, and you find that America's disregard for the well-being of these migrants is not new. There were about 219 migrant deaths due to heat at the United States southern border in 2021 fiscal year, which the CBP measures from October 2020 to September 2021, up from about 100 deaths in each of the previous 3 years. CBP data shows last year's figures were not included. Human rights, cross borders, the United States wants you to believe. Yet, those rights appear not to apply when someone seeks to cross the border into the U.S. That is not a message that aligns with the country's often stated exceptionalism. Thank you.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: يوم المظلوم على الظالم أشد من يوم الظالم على المظلوم.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The day of the oppressed over the oppressor will be severer than the day of the oppressor over the oppressed."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, we find in our lives that we might have committed sins, an unfortunate reality. Of course, because of the modern day and age in which we live in, sometimes it is, I don't want to say unavoidable, but sometimes it is very easy to commit sin because of the environment in which we live in. Everybody seems to have a handheld smart device. Everybody has access to the internet. Everybody, you know, in the Western world, it's even worse because there's access to things such as alcohol and drugs and promiscuity and ethical and moral corruption as well. But because of all these kind of negative and evil factors and variables, we end up running into committing sins. Now, one of the things that we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is regarding forgiveness, but more so than forgiveness is this idea of remorse. And it's really beautiful because the before asking for forgiveness and doing istighfar, this stage or this phase of remorse is very important. This feeling of being ashamed, this feeling of being remorseful, regretful, embarrassed for having committed a certain sin. And so in the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam and in his universal persona, we find that this is something that is very integral, and it is a pillar of istighfar and asking for forgiveness, to the point where we find Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says in one place that remorse for a sin counts as seeking forgiveness. And so again, this aspect of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which is very beautiful, despite being infallible, despite being immaculate, we find this sense of asking the Almighty Allah for forgiveness. And the most beautiful place that we find this is in the Dua Kumail, this supplication of Kumail, which was taught to Kumail ibn Ziyad by Imam Ali alayhi salam. And how profound is the idea of remorse and asking for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah, despite the fact that, you know, he did not commit any sin, but still this beautiful aspect of remorse, this beautiful aspect of seeking forgiveness emanates from this pure and blessed being of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Commander of the Faithful. And we too need to inculcate this in our daily lives. We need to reflect and contemplate and go over some of the sins, if not all of the sins, if that is possible to do, that we might have committed in our lives, and then to truly feel remorseful how we wasted an opportunity to be able to do good, how we wasted an opportunity to turn away from the disobedience of the Almighty Allah. Be remorseful, be ashamed, be embarrassed. But then, after that remorse, we have to ask for forgiveness. And here we find that the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is teaching us that, listen, when you are remorseful and you decide to not commit that sin again because you feel ashamed and you feel embarrassed, the Almighty Allah is so incredibly merciful that He will forgive you even just based upon that remorse. Now, that doesn't mean that we should stop at the remorse. Matter of fact, we should move forward and ask for forgiveness. And hopefully that forgiveness comes about with tears and tears of regret and tears of remorse. And, then it will be, as they say, nurun ala nur, light upon light, that not only will the Almighty Allah forgive us based upon our remorse, but the Almighty Allah will also forgive us based upon our forgiveness, inshallah. A very beautiful and moving lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away. and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. Do you want to be healthy and feel good? Perhaps you won't find anyone not sharing this goal. Whilst there's a plethora of advice online and by experts, we have wonderful recommendations in Islamic teachings, including the sayings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. They all lived a healthy life and would love their followers to be healthy too. For instance, I have personally found hundreds of narrations on healthy lifestyle from the Commander of the Faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi as-salam. Here are tips in this regard. The art of eating. In advice to his son, Imam al-Hasan alayhi as-salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, states, "Do not eat unless you're hungry. Leave eating whilst you're still hungry and chew the food very well." Number 5, do not overeat. Overeating causes illness. Excessive eating corrupts the soul. Be wary of eating too much, for it darkens the heart. These are some of the narrations from Imam alayhi salam highlighting the dangers of excessive consumption of food. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations where we lose self-control or feel pressure to eat. Even those may be situations where we may not be hungry. For example, we find ourselves when we have to eat from buffets or when we go from one invitation to another. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam once again links food consumption to the health of one's soul, the nafs, and highlights how the path of spirituality is illuminated with moderation and avoidance of excessiveness. In the book Ghurar al-Hikam, Imam Ali alayhi salam is reported to have said, "If you reduce how much you eat, your intellectual ability will enhance." Number 6, the night worship. At first glance, you might be thinking, how is this linked to a healthy lifestyle? Well, in a number of traditions, it is reported that Imam Ali alayhi salam said, to stay up at night worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings about health for the body, pleasure of the Lord, adherence to the ways of the prophets, and pouring of God's mercy. This is probably mainly linked to praying the night prayer, Salatul Layl, which can be prayed any time at night, but preferably after midnight.
Do Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, an ethics committee has recommended revoking former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani's law license over his attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A Washington, D.C. Bar Association review panel is recommending former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani be disbanded in Washington for his handling of litigation challenging the 2020 election on behalf of then-President Donald Trump. Rudy Giuliani claimed massive election fraud but had no evidence, wrote the three-lawyer panel in a report released on Friday, 7th of July, regarding the errors and unsupported claims in a Pennsylvania lawsuit he argued seeking to overturn the Republican president's loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Between Election Day and the 6th of January 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, Rudy Giuliani and other Trump lawyers repeatedly pressed claims of election fraud that were almost uniformly rejected by federal and state courts. He's the third lawyer who could lose his ability to practice law over what he did for Donald Trump. John Eastman faces disbarment in California, and Lynn Wood this week surrendered his license in Georgia. Mr. Giuliani's effort to undermine the integrity of the 2020 presidential election has helped destabilize our democracy, wrote the three lawyers on the panel. Robert Bernius, Carolyn Hainsworth Murrell, and Jay Brozost. The panel's report will now go to the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals for a final decision. Ted Goodman, a political advisor to Rudy Giuliani, criticized the panel's work in a statement. The decision makers at the Washington, D.C. Bar Association are nothing more than an arm of the permanent regime in Washington. Ted Goodman said the decision is also part of an effort to deny President Trump effective counsel by persecuting Rudy Giuliani, objectively one of the most effective prosecutors in American history. This is the sort of behavior we'd expect out of the Soviet Union, not America, he added, and he called on members of the Washington, D.C. Bar Association to speak out against this great injustice. Rudy Giuliani's law license in New York was suspended in June of 2021 for false statements he made while trying to pursue Donald Trump's repeatedly debunked fraud claims. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Rudy Giuliani's law license should be revoked over his work on a failed lawsuit challenging the 2020 election results on behalf of then-President Donald Trump, a Washington, D.C. Attorney Ethics Committee has recommended. He now faces being disbarred in the Capitol after a review panel late on Friday, 7th of July, condemned a lawyer and former politician for aggressively pursuing the false assertions of Donald Trump, the false assertions that Donald Trump made about his defeat by Democratic rival and now U.S. President Joe Biden. Giuliani claimed massive election fraud but had no evidence, wrote the three-member panel in a report that details the errors and unsupported claims the former mayor of New York City made in a Pennsylvania lawsuit seeking to overturn the election result. Between the November 2020 election day and the 6th of January 2021 insurrection by supporters of Donald Trump at the U.S. Capitol, Rudolph Giuliani and other Trump lawyers repeatedly pressed claims of election fraud that were untrue and almost uniformly rejected by federal and state courts. He's the third lawyer who could lose his ability to practice law over what he did for Donald Trump. John Eastman faces disbarment in California, and Lynn Wood this week surrendered his law license in Georgia. Mr. Giuliani's efforts to undermine the integrity of the 2020 presidential election has helped destabilize our democracy, wrote the panel members. The panel members were Robert Bernius, Carolyn Hainsworth Murrell, and Jay Brozost. The misconduct here sadly transcends all his past accomplishments, they wrote. It was unparalleled in its destructive purpose and effect. He sought to disrupt the presidential election and persists in his refusal to acknowledge the wrong that he has done. Rudolph Giuliani has already had his New York law license suspended for false statements he made after the election. The Washington Review Panel's work will now go to the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals for a final decision. Ted Goodman, a political advisor to Rudy Giuliani, called for support from Washington lawyers and criticized the panel's work as the sort of behavior we'd expect out of the former Soviet Union. Rudolph Giuliani ran a short and disastrous campaign for the Republican presidential nomination in the 2008 election. The Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani will be disbarred in Washington after a review panel on Friday, 7th of July, condemned how he pursued the false claims that the then-President Donald Trump made about his 2020 presidential election loss. Rudy Giuliani claimed massive election fraud but had no evidence, wrote the three-member panel. In a report that details the errors and unsupported claims the former mayor made in a Pennsylvania lawsuit seeking to overturn the Republican president's loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Between Election Day and the 6th of January 2021 riot at the U.S. Capitol, Rudy Giuliani and other Trump lawyers repeatedly pressed claims of election fraud that were almost uniformly rejected by federal and state courts. He's the third lawyer who could lose his ability to practice law over what he did for Donald Trump. John Eastman faces disbarment in California, and Lynn Wood this week surrendered his law license in Georgia. Mr. Giuliani's effort to undermine the integrity of the 2020 presidential election has helped destabilize our democracy, wrote the panel. The panel is made up of Robert Bernius, Carolyn Hainsworth Murrell, and Jay Brozost. The misconduct here sadly transcends all his past accomplishments, they wrote. It was unparalleled in its destructive purpose and effect. He sought to disrupt the presidential election and persists in his refusal to acknowledge the wrong that he has done. Giuliani has already had his New York law license suspended for false statements that he made after the election. The Washington Review Panel's work will now go on to the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals for a final decision. Ted Goodman, a political advisor to Giuliani, criticized the panel's work as an attempt to persecute Giuliani and part of a larger effort to deny President Trump effective counsel. I call on rank-and-file members of the Washington, D.C. Bar Association to speak out against this great injustice, Goodman said in a statement. Giuliani's post-election work has made him a key figure in several federal and state probes. He met with the special counsel appointed to investigate efforts to overturn the 2020 election and prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, also conducting an investigation. The panel examined a case that Giuliani argued on 17th of November 2020, just 10 days after the Associated Press and other news outlets had called the election for Joe Biden. The Trump campaign complained that Philadelphia and six Democratic-controlled counties in Pennsylvania let voters make corrections to mail-in ballots that were otherwise going to be disqualified for a technicality, such as lacking a secrecy envelope or a signature. Some other counties did not follow suit. Rudolph Giuliani argued the case. While he had once served as a U.S. attorney in New York, the Pennsylvania's argument was his first court appearance as an attorney since 1992, the year before he was elected New York mayor, according to federal records. He spent much of the hearing baselessly alleging a national conspiracy to steal the election from Donald Trump, something that the former president continues to argue today.
Bazaar.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host, Ali Reza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to see how they help advance various industries and explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities.
However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures.
The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades, yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages.
In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative, high-tech productions for exports. Iran is no stranger to the handwoven carpet market. Traditionally, the country has been weaving carpets for millennia with skills passed down through generations, some even as highly protected family secrets. Iranians were among the pioneers of weaving carpets, and with years of experience, they have achieved a great deal of perfection in this arena. The craft has represented Iran's rich culture and heritage for centuries and has been adored all over the world. Our quest for answers led us to the 29th International Exhibition of Handmade Iranian Carpets. This event is viewed by many industry participants as the world's largest handmade carpet expo when it comes to quantity and quality. Visitors were dazzled by thousands of handwoven carpets in all sorts of contemporary and traditional design patterns. The exhibition is a place for national and international trade and commercial envoys to visit in order to size up the market and make business deals. All sorts of carpets are found here that were brought in from all corners of Iran, including very rare rugs. We caught up with a few vendors to see what type of activities they carry out. A high-quality Iranian carpet can cost thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong, compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather because of their materials, design, and overall size. While some rug varieties follow specific designs, most are entirely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs and their personal design touch to the carpet. Handwoven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Most handwoven carpets are produced in rural areas. Furthermore, women make up the majority of carpet weavers and produce raw materials such as silk and wool in rural areas. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers who frequently receive the least profit from their products. This is mainly due to numerous middlemen businesses that make money from carpets. Cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the production chain by linking material producers with weavers and buyers to complete a production cycle. The massive exhibition is one of the best places to get a bird's eye view of this thriving market. Yes, ironically, one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets used to be the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, owing to the US-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find alternate avenues to satisfy their cravings for these highly coveted carpets. For centuries, the Iranian carpet has represented the country's rich culture and art. Its stunning design and exquisite quality have turned the ancient craft into a lucrative commodity sought after by many across the world. But Iran's handwoven carpet exports have also seen numerous ups and downs over the decades. Industry participants say the U.S. sanctions tried to pull the rug out from under the Persian carpet legacy, but the move didn't work and only seems to have increased the world's demand for these items. 1994 was the golden period for Iranian handwoven carpet exports. Back then, exports peaked at over $2 billion. Later down